A Tempo is a production of the Classical Network and is made possible by the support of listeners like you. Thank you for your support. Welcome to A Tempo, the Classical Network spotlight on the arts and culture. I'm Rachel Katz, and I'm your host as we explore the changes at work in the performing arts. Each week, I'll bring you some of the latest news and also take time to examine many of the issues that are challenging arts organizations. We'll look at the impact of the economy, technology, and society on the arts, the importance of arts education, and how these organizations and ensembles are adjusting and innovating as they face the future. Today, I'll sit down with Barbara Hawes, who this month is retiring as archivist of the New York Philharmonic, a position she has held for more than three decades. She'll talk about what she's discovered over the years about the music, the orchestra, and the musicians, and also about her efforts to digitize major portions of the orchestra's collection. As part of A Tempo, we're pleased to bring you some of the news from around the world of the performing arts. Pianist Jonathan Biss has been named co-artistic director of the Marlborough Music Festival, serving alongside Mitsuko Uchida, who has held the position for the past 26 years. In a statement, Marlborough Music Chair and President Christopher Serkin said the appointment marked an important evolution in the festival, held annually on the campus of Vermont's Marlborough College. As co-artistic directors, Biss and Uchida will guide and oversee the festival's artistic and educational programs. A state-owned Chinese firm is considering buying the company that makes Steinway pianos, according to a report by Bloomberg News. Citing people familiar with the matter, Bloomberg reported the China Polygroup Corp. is conducting due diligence as it considers buying Steinway Musical Instruments, which was bought in 2013 by the New York-based investment firm Paulson & Company. Polygroup, a conglomerate which supplied the Chinese military with defense equipment in the 1990s, has since expanded into real estate, mining, the arts, and explosives, according to Bloomberg. The Cleveland Orchestra is celebrating a nearly $10 million bequest from the great-granddaughter of one of the founders of Quaker Oats. The Plain Dealer reported that the estate of Gene Howard Tabor has bequeathed $9.3 million to the orchestra, in addition to a $500,000 distribution from a charitable gift annuity that Tabor had established. The orchestra plans to dedicate one of its concerts this weekend at the Blossom City Music Center to Tabor, who was a member of the orchestra's Heritage Society. The gift is among the largest ever received by the orchestra. Those are just some of the headlines this week from around the arts world. For nearly 3.5 decades, Barbara Hawes has served as archivist of the New York Philharmonic. During that time, she has helped organize and catalog the myriads of papers, programs, letters, meeting minutes, and other documents that track the business and musical history of the ensemble, as well as its audio recordings. In this role, Hawes has helped bring this history to life, both by assisting various researchers and authors in their own explorations, and also through the Philharmonic's own projects, such as overseeing the release of CD sets of recordings, and most recently, the digitization of much of the Philharmonic's programs and other written history. This month, Hawes is retiring from that role, with plans to pursue a doctorate in musicology at Oxford and delve into the life and career of Eureli Corelli Hill, who founded the New York Philharmonic Society in 1842. The fact that she didn't have a musicology degree when she first applied for the job hadn't deterred Hawes from seeking out the position back in 1984, given her attraction to the history of New York City and its major institutions. I chatted with her recently, surrounded by books, boxes, and photos of some of the Philharmonic's conductors and musicians, about what first brought her to the role and some of her accomplishments.
I was really interested in 19th century New York. I'm originally from Nebraska. I arrived in New York City in 1977 just before the 1977 blackout, just before newspaper strike, garbage strike. Lived on Columbus Avenue, 71st Street, which some people at that time thought was so dangerous they wouldn't come to visit. And I absolutely fell in love with the place. West Side Highway at that time was elevated still. You could get on a bicycle at 72nd Street about and ride. But it was in such disrepair that cars couldn't be on it anymore. There were actual really complete holes through the highway. But you could get on and ride your bicycle all the way down to Battery Park. So there were these magical sides of New York due to its decrepitude that just made it an exhilarating place. And for the first time, even though I'd been raised in the Midwest, and I never aspired to move to New York, it wasn't part of my dream to come here and do anything. So it was by accident that I showed up. I fell in love with the place. And being a born-again New Yorker, it means that you're kind of the most rabid and maybe obnoxious about the history of the place. And so it was, in particular, studying the 19th century that really motivated me. And so I went to NYU and got, after a few years of working in a lot of different jobs in the city, which was really a lot of fun to do. Nothing on a career path, just to be in New York and work and see what things were like. But then I decided to go and get my master's degree in history at NYU, and they had a program in archival management, historical editing. And the first job I had was at the Bowery Savings Bank, which was founded in 1834. But it was a Stanford White building on Bowery and Grand, and it was just a marvelous way of kind of seeing all the basements of New York City. You know, it was to be the archivist in these places. And then I went and worked for Jackie Robinson's widow, Rachel Robinson, on Jackie's collection. And then there was an ad in the paper for the New York Philharmonic. And it wasn't the fact that it was a musical organization. It wasn't the fact that it was an orchestra. It was the fact that it was an 1842 New York institution. That was my interest. And that's how I really got here. They advertised for a musicologist. I must have overlooked that side of it. I mean, they said they wanted an archivist, but they wanted someone with some musicology background. And they, in fact, said to me when they invited me in for an interview that really the only reason they had done that is I was the only non-musicologist to apply for the job, and they wanted to know why I thought I could do the job. And I very matter-of-factly and naively said, well, I think you have enough musicians. What you need is a good historian. And, you know, I think they just, and I had a plan too. I mean, I was very self-confident as an archivist. I loved being an archivist, and I still love being an archivist. And so I think they thought that maybe I was quirky enough, or maybe I was just the right person to be thrown into the basement of then Avery Fisher Hall and with 1,000 boxes of material and saying, okay, make sense of this.
So what was your first challenge?
So the reason they decided they needed an archivist is because they'd accumulated so much material. Sometimes an institution hires an archivist because they've lost all their material and they need to try to repatriate it in some way or get that history back. In this case, they had amassed a huge collection. And this is partly due to the kind of mindset of the early Philharmonicers in the 19th century. They were a cooperative institution. They called themselves sometimes a communistic institution society. They were managed and run by the musicians themselves. The musicians hired the conductor for never more than a year contract, and they decided, and they would make anyone who was to be a conductor become a member of the orchestra too. So they you know, sold the tickets, managed the books, controlled the library, the paper library, and they did that for 66 years. And in that time period, they decided they would write everything down. And partly, and this is why I exist here, because if you're a partnership and you're sharing in proceeds and you share in assets, in order to trust each other, you write everything down. You document it carefully. So, for instance, there was a system of fines. If you didn't show up at rehearsal, you had to pay in, say, 50 cents. If you didn't show up for a concert, you had to pay a dollar. Well, when it's money out of pocket, and I'm going to maybe accuse you of saying you still owe us $1.50 for those concerts you didn't show up to, or the rehearsal you didn't show up to, you might say, I was too there. And the only way you can prove what is owed or what is not is owed is if it's all written down. So they kept remarkable records, detailed records. And then they got into kind of their own kind of crazy mindset of like, we're going to create detailed records of things that aren't even important. That was just kind of where they were. And they did this for 66 years, till 1909 when Mahler came. But so the die was set. And so this collecting and this documentation just carried on. So the first big challenge was the fact that they had 1,000 boxes of this material, and they didn't have an overriding catalog. They'd tried over the years to kind of write things down of where it was, and that works as long as you never use the material. It's not collecting that people have a hard time with. People love to collect. People love to catalog. But what they don't like to do is to put it away. Once you pull it out, it is no fun to go and put that away where it belongs so you can find it again. That's why we all hire assistants. But anyway, they'd had a big 10,000th concert in 1982, and they'd pulled everything out to celebrate their history and to do a huge multimedia program on the stage with Zubin conducting Mahler II, and they did a booklet, and they did exhibits, and they did a tremendous amount of celebrating that used the archives, and then no one wanted to put it away. So there it was, stacked and stacked and stacked in this room, and when I arrived and opened the door, there was this lovely photograph of Mahler from the time. I mean, it wasn't the only copy. It was his promotional shot from 1909 when he'd been music director and hired as music director. But that was there on the floor, and on it was this sweet little dead mouse. And that's kind of the state of the room at that time. So that was one of the big challenges, just to figure out what's what and what where it is. But one of the real pleasures of being an archivist is you can't mind being lost. Because you will be lost for a while, and you just have to not let that bother you. You just have to go, you open a box and you start to write down kind of a basic overview of what's there, what strikes you as interesting. Then you go on to the next box, and you write that down, next box. Because at this time, we didn't have computers. So everything was written down on yellow legal pads to try to get a sense of what was where. And then you got a sense of maybe how it fit together and what belonged where. But that's typical of kind of a big institution. But this was a lot more fun because it wasn't just a business like any other business. It's a business of geniuses. Hmm. It's a business of egos, tremendous egos. I mean, and it's not just egos of, the CEO or the ego of the board. This is the egos of all the musicians. And they all do, and they all have their own kind of quirky demands and necessities, and the difference between the trombone section and the violin section is miles wide, right? They're different personalities, and they have different needs, and they have different interests, and all of that kind of starts to get expressed within the orchestra, and within the records themselves.
Well, you mentioned that when they asked you why you were interested, you were a musicologist. How do you think, when you came having more of a historian focus as opposed to specifically a musical historian focus, affected and impacted the way you settled in and forged ahead?
Well, I mean, that's what I've done all these years, right, is I've tried to interpret this music institution in a humanistic way. it's not about the music, it's about the performers. And that's how I've seen the orchestra. There is a lot written about composers. There's a lot written about works of music. There's so little written about performance history. There's so little written about what does an orchestra in Paris do with this work that's different than a orchestra 50 years later in New York do with this work. Performances don't exist in isolation. They exist within a culture of a place. They exist within the culture of an audience. They exist within the culture of music criticism. And they all start to get modified or slightly changed, or our ears hear differently based on what we're going through at a certain particular time. And that's what I really find interesting about this place, is that it was a way of interpreting the people over time, the people that were interpreting, whether it's and I don't see this as just being a conductor, I see it as being the musicians themselves and what they bring to it. And I just feel, too, I've just started to scratch the surface of it in some ways, because just when you think you know something, you know there's one other way to look at it. So you take a certain event, you take a concert on a certain day at a certain time, and there are 100 musicians on stage who have brought their own kind of traditions and temperaments and experience to this particular work that they're all trying to share. And then you have a conductor who's trying to communicate to them what he wants. Whether that's successful or not kind of depends on how well they are all working together, or maybe what their own background is. So the orchestra reflects the immigration history of this mm-hmm. city as well. And so you have the Italian influence. We start out with major a German influence after the 1848 revolution, and then you start to have the Russian influence and the Italian influence. And it wasn't a very friendly place when you had, you know, nearly equal amounts of Italian and Russians. You know, there's one orchestra personnel manager sheet where he recounts that he has to break up a fist fight backstage. The language issues are always very interesting. And then you start, because of the advent of great conservatories in the United States, and then the music body becomes even more American, but maybe from the Midwest or the West Coast. And you start to see that change. And what does that sensibility bring to it? And now today, with the major influx of Asian, excellent Asian musicians, we are now going through another immigration phase of where we're reflecting then the transition into what is that? What are they bringing? What kind of experience are they bringing from their home countries into this orchestra? And how does it either change the orchestra, or how does it change them?
And what about the personalities? Who would you say have been some of the outstanding personalities, either that you've had the chance to work with while you've been here, or that have just jumped out through the collections?
The orchestra wasn't a full-time job until 1964. Mm-hmm. So it was a 52-week, then it became a 52-week contract. Before that, a musician in the orchestra might work 38 weeks, and they would do their best maybe to provide some summer work for them. But what it meant is you had a group of musicians then who would come and be committed to the orchestra for about 36, 38 weeks. And then some would go to Hollywood to play in the movies. Some would go and play in festivals. Some would play at Lewisohn Stadium in upstate, in Upper Manhattan. They would go and get whatever kind of gig they could get. So they had a different kind of almost a vaudevillian kind of attitude towards their profession. And after 1964, and then with kind of the extraordinary conservatories that are coming up within the United States, I mean, they've been around, Curtis had been around, of course, Juilliard had been around for a long time, but it was still hard to imagine getting a full-time job as a musician. And so now you have more conservatory-trained musicians, because they don't have to go. So if you imagine a vaudevillian mentality towards to the conservatory-trained mentality, you see a real difference in this kind of thing. They still are. I think musicians are some of the most entrepreneurial people around, because they can take, you can get two people, three people, four people together with instruments, and they will create music, they will create a concert, they will be able to put together something that will give them enough money to buy dinner. And they are always very entrepreneurial. And that still exists. I still see that among so many of our musicians who are forming their own ensembles for the summer so that they can go where they want to go, or to make extra income or whatever that is. The thing, though, that struck me, one example, and I can't explain to you why they think this way. In 1865, when the Philharmonic performed a concert in honor of, or in memoriam to, Abraham Lincoln, they played the first three movements of Beethoven's Ninth Symphony. They decided to omit the last movement, the Ode to Joy, because they thought it was inappropriate for the occasion to play something called Ode to Joy. On the 10th anniversary of 9/11, management, we were thinking about performing a concert in Central Park in honor of the 10th anniversary of 9/11, and we thought we'd do maybe the Beethoven Ninth. You know, it's about the spirit of mankind and coming together and, you know, all the right things you want to recognize in mankind. And management, and I was sitting there at the table with us, and it was like, well, that's a great idea. That sounds very nice. And when it was presented to the musicians, their immediate reaction was, we can't play the Ode to Joy. And I said, oh, just like the orchestra in 1865. Now, I don't have any idea if it really was that, but it was the same reaction. But it came from the musicians on the stage. I don't know what to make of that, but I found it just fascinating. I'd say that's why I've stayed here. I was going to stay here about 7 years, but, you know, 34 years later, I am still fascinated with this most extraordinary, complex animal, a symphony orchestra.
What have been some of your favorite items that you have found along the way, or favorite projects that you've been able to put together?
In the 90s, in the 1990s, we started to produce historic broadcasts from the archives. And so we produced something like 60 or 70 CDs worth of box sets. And that was just a whole other side. That's not what most archivists end up doing. But it was an opportunity to use the archival material to reach more people and to say what we were about. There was, of course, then the digitization project is truly life-changing, and that's because of the Leon Levy Foundation. We come up with a lot of good ideas. We think they're good ideas, and other people might say they're good ideas. But what's truly rare is when somebody says, yeah, that's a good idea, and I'll give you all the money you need to do it. It's extraordinary. That's life-changing. It's also terrifying because now you have to do it. There are no excuses. But so the idea, though, of taking this collection, which is the longest running, continuously running performance history in the world, I suppose they exist probably, maybe with the Leipzig Gewandhaus too. But I think this is there's more concerts of this, and being able to make it available to the world online is just a remarkable experience and opportunity. I mean, I got the job done, but it's still really it's because of all the belief in not just in me, but in the story that the archives tells, and the story of the Philharmonic.
Now, is that something that's ongoing in terms of things, items, and collections that are still going to be put on? Or where are you with right now?
We've digitized every scrap of paper from 1970 back to 1842. Oh. Because that's the time period where it's open to research. And then we have digitized all public-facing documents, meaning annual reports, press releases, press clippings, marketing material from 1970 on up to now about 2005. It should continue. It probably needs more funding. I have to say, so I can't be absolute with that. And then there's also the audio collection, which is a tremendous, I mean, we have one of the largest radio broadcast collections because beginning in 1930, the Philharmonic would broadcast every Sunday coast to coast. And so it's a huge legacy of the audio, and it only makes sense that that would be the next step, is to get that digitized, so that not only can you see the marked score that Leonard Bernstein used, and you can hear the radio broadcast, and you can read the newspaper clippings of the reviews of that concert, and see all the parts that were on the stands of the musicians. It's all sides of this one event, and that it's very, very special. So I think it's just such a logical next step that I think it probably will happen. But it won't be up to me. So
what were some of the biggest challenges in the digitization project?
Oh, getting things done quickly. And why I say that's important is because that reduced the cost. The price of digitization using standard kind of scanners that you watch go ding, ding, back and forth, it takes too long. And that means each item, the more time something takes, the more it costs to get done. So what we did was, with the help of a remarkable photographer, Ardon Barhama, was to create a system using cameras and then to do a lot of work in post-production, meaning that, so you'd take 1,000 images, or you'd take 300 images, more likely, and you would crop them all in a batch file instead of one by one. Anyway, we developed workflows that I think Henry Ford would have been proud of, because it was an assembly line of where we prep the material, get it to the photographers, shoot, post-produce, get it back to the proofers to make sure it was accurate, get metadata in, and off we go. And so we at one point had 3 cameras set up here, and each camera could do 2,000 shots a day. So, you know, to think about processing 6,000 pages a day, yeah, that's a day. And then the amount of people you had to have to get, so you had to have about 16 people in order to prep and then proof and that whole cycle. I did a lot of diagramming. It's really not very interesting history work, but I can do workflows now.
That was Barbara Hawes, who is retiring this month as archivist of the New York Philharmonic after 34 years. I'll continue my conversation with Hawes next week, when she'll talk about some of the personalities that have shown throughout the New York Philharmonic's history, including Leonard Bernstein. You can access the online archive, which currently includes features on the Toscanini years and the ties between the New York and Vienna Philharmonics, both founded in 1842, at nyphil.org. I hope you enjoy these conversations that I bring you each week on A Tempo, focusing on the changing dynamics and challenges in the classical performing arts world. But remember that programs like this are made possible only through your support of this station. To become a member of the Classical Network, go to wwfm.org and click on Donate. Thank you for being a member of the global listening community that is the Classical Network. Thank you for listening to A Tempo. I'm your host and producer, Rachel Katz. Join me again next week as we explore more issues and trends in the world of the performing arts. You can listen to past programs of A Tempo by going to our arts and cultural news page at wwfm.org or searching for A Tempo on our program page. A Tempo is a production of the Classical Network and is made possible by the support of listeners like you.